This is Bill Munhausen with another episode of What Makes Sense. I'm going to begin with the story of Yeonmi Park, an immigrant defector from communist North Korea, because her experience living under socialism and escaping it serves as an excellent warning for Americans. She begins with an observation comparing woke U.S. ideology in education to her experience in the poverty of a socialist regime. They were in Manhattan, living in the freest country you can imagine, and they're saying they're oppressed. It doesn't even compute, Yeonmi Park related about students at her alma mater, Columbia University. I was sold for $20 as a sex slave in the 21st century under the same sky, and they say they're oppressed because people can't follow the pronouns they invent every day. The 29-year-old defected from North Korea as a young teen, only to be human trafficked in China. In 2014, she became one of just 200 North Koreans to live in the United States, and is now an American citizen. 4 years after, she graduated from Columbia with a degree in economics. Park is raising alarm bells about America's cancel culture and woke ideology. In her book, While Time Remains, Park writes how she made it all the way to the United States, only to find some of the same encroachments on freedom that she thought she left behind in North Korea, from identity politics and victim mentality to elite hypocrisy. I escaped hell on earth and walked across the desert in search of freedom and found it, she writes. I don't want anything bad ever to happen to my new home. I want us, need us, to keep the darkness at bay. She implores readers, I need your help to save our country while time remains. Park first made headlines back in 2015 with her book In Order to Live, A North Korean Girl's Journey to Freedom, and for her bold claims that the woke environment she endured as a student at Columbia reminded her of North Korea. Park recently recalled what it was like to be a North Korean defector who escaped tyranny and oppression, only to meet college students intent on claiming victim status and earning oppression points. She observed that many of her classmates at New York City's most elite school were brainwashed like North Korean students are. I never understood that not having a problem can be a problem, Park said. They need to make injustice out of thin air or a problem out of nowhere because they haven't experienced anything like what other people are facing in the world. Her observation is that young people in particular are looking for purpose, and crusading against a perceived problem gives them purpose. However, perception is relative, and residents of a free society misidentify ordinary circumstances as a life struggle. The young people we refer to as snowflakes may actually be caring individuals looking for a cause. Park's perspective is very different. In the first 5 years of her life, an estimated 3.5 million North Koreans died of starvation. Park recalls hunting for cockroaches on the way to school to quell her hunger, even as the government banned the words famine and hunger. Darkness where I come from is total, Park writes. It's not just the absence of light, power, and food. It is the absence of dignity, sanctuary, and hope. Darkness is watching your parents and neighbors hauled away by police for the crime of collecting insects and plants for their children to eat. Her mother told her the most dangerous thing in her body was her tongue, and warned her that if she said the wrong thing or insulted the regime, her family could be imprisoned or even executed. After her father was arrested and sentenced to hard labor for the crime of trading salt and sugar, the Park family's life in North Korea deteriorated even further. I didn't escape in search of freedom or liberty or safety. I escaped in search of a bowl of rice, she writes. Along with her mother and older sister, she eventually made her way to the U.S. Park's sister fled North Korea first, Park then 13, and her mother followed, crossing the freezing Yalu River into China. But rather than finding her sister, the pair fell into the hands of human traffickers who sold Park into sexual slavery. After years of forced labor, a still teenage Park was finally able to break free and travel across the Gobi Desert to Mongolia with the help of Christian missionaries. From there, she went to South Korea, where she found refuge and was granted citizenship. 7 years after they were first separated, Park also reunited with her older sister, but they found out that their father had died shortly after he managed to escape to China. Losing him, Park said, made her step into a different life, one dedicated to human rights and improving the lives of people suffering under tyranny. A life of meaning, a life that would make my father proud. That's the end result of cancel culture, Park said. Of course, we're not putting people in front of a firing squad in America now, but their livelihoods, their dignity, their reputations, and their humanity are under attack. When we tell people not to talk, we're censoring their thinking as well. And when you can't think, you're a slave, a brainwashed puppet. Park calls her Ivy League alma mater, Columbia University, a pure indoctrination camp, where students create their own victimhood and alleged injustices out of thin air. Students behave this way because they are a product of the university's culture. Since her time at Columbia, the New York City-based author and activist has started a YouTube channel, Voice of North Korea, where she shares information about life under a socialist regime. She also joined the board of the nonprofit Human Rights Foundation, where she works with dissidents from around the world, and most recently helped with efforts to drop anti-regime leaflets in North Korea. Recently divorced, Park is also now a mother to a 5-year-old son. She wants him to have the same freedoms she found in America, but is afraid they're under attack by pernicious woke ideology, and especially identity politics. In North Korea, Park said, the government divides citizens into 51 classes based on whether their blood is tainted because their ancestors were oppressive landowners. Park asserts the same ideology that led North Korea to categorize citizens is being put into young minds of Americans. That's how the regime divided people. What an individual does doesn't matter. It's all about your ancestors and the collective, she explained. That philosophy is reflected in the idea of reparations, whereby the white Americans of today must compensate minority groups for the perceived sins of white ancestors. Now, when she sees Americans indulging in race, essentialism, and identity politics, she said it feels eerily familiar. They say white people are privileged and guilty and oppressors, Park said. This is the tactic the North Korean regime used to divide people. In America, it's the same idea of collective guilt. This is the ideology that drove North Korea to be what it is today, and we're putting it into young American minds. Park concludes, I really don't think that we have that much time left. Already, all our mainstream institutions have the same ideology that North Korea has, socialism, collectivism, and equity. We are literally going through a cultural revolution in America. When Americans realize what's happening, it might be too late. You can follow Yeonmi Park on her YouTube channel, Voice of North Korea. Let me pivot now to a somewhat related story about a leftist movement called Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, often referred to as DEI. I have adapted this description of DEI from Wikipedia. DEI refers to organizational frameworks which seek to promote the fair treatment and full participation of all people, particularly groups who have historically been underrepresented or subject to discrimination on the basis of identity or disability. Diversity, equity, and inclusion together represent three closely linked values which organizations seek to institutionalize through DEI frameworks. Diversity refers to the presence of variety within the organizational workforce based on identity. For example, gender, culture, ethnicity, religion, disability, class, etc., age or opinion. Equity refers to concepts of fairness and justice, such as fair compensation. More specifically, equity usually also includes a focus on societal disparities and allocating resources and decision-making authority to groups that have historically been disadvantaged, and taking into consideration a person's unique circumstances, adjusting treatment accordingly so that the end result is equal. Inclusion refers to creating an organizational culture that creates an experience where all employees feel their voices will be heard and experience a sense of belonging and integration. That is pretty much the description from Wikipedia after taking out the various footnotes and hyperlinks. What is DEI? Think about affirmative action from the 1960s, under which universities had to admit a certain percentage of minority students, and businesses needed to apply similar quotas to their hiring practices. DEI is affirmative action on steroids, and it is an easy sell for corporations who were previously troubled by litigation claiming discrimination in the workforce. By following the dictates of DEIs, corporations become lawsuit-proof because they hire from every conceivable minority group, including those defined by sexual preference, political persuasion, age, disability, cultural affiliation, and more. Probably the only downside to the diversity standard is that the definition of minority groups is almost infinitely variable because we haven't defined all the minorities yet. Equity sounds pretty good until you realize that equity can be applied to the past. For example, Native Americans were displaced by European settlers over a century ago. So their descendants living today need a hand up. Equity means righting the wrongs of the past. Inclusion represents the idea that every one of these minorities have to feel like they have a say in their company and that they have a sense of belonging. That's a tough one because its successful implementation runs contrary to human nature. People tend to get in conflict with one another, but conflict would be a violation of inclusiveness. That means corporations must discipline employees who don't cooperate. It's that whole authoritarian thing that infests socialism. DEI is on a collision course with normal society, but it's being adopted in one form or another by many major corporations whose management finds it easier to accept the ideology rather than risk the consequences of non-compliance. Advocates are already anticipating negative reactions from the general public. An Vo, chief culture officer at Alford Group, has worked extensively in advancing racial dialogues and the practice of justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion in her work. As engagement in DEI work deepens, it becomes clear that well-intentioned pledges of commitment to incorporate core values of diversity, equity, and inclusion are not enough. Your team may be grappling with questions like, how do we transform words on the page into reality? Or what are the actual actions we can take to realize our vision of a culture of diversity, equity, and inclusion? And how can we prepare ourselves for the challenges that we will bump up against? Your team may be thinking, equity work is hard, so how do we stay motivated and engaged through the process? An Vo certainly seems to have her work cut out for her. Throughout the article are clues regarding where the author is coming from. What we learn along the way as we encounter resistance reveals the author's intuition that many people will object to DEI, but he or she won't use that to reevaluate the value of DEI. Another quote reads, "When someone is met with forms of hostility, microaggression, retaliation, and white fragility pushing back at them, seems like people are going to hate DEI, and they might be the white fragile people." Speaking of microaggression, this last statement is a little shot against white mainstream America. Advocates of DEI use racist terms to dismiss their opponents, and we shouldn't fall for it. We should reason. I'd like to make a case against diversity. The characteristics that make nations, truly any group or people, successful is unity, not diversity. It's our national motto, E pluribus unum, out of many is one nation. When my parents immigrated to the United States from Germany in the 1930s, they were intent on becoming Americans. America was referred to as the Great Melting Pot, because its philosophy was to dissolve ethnic differences and mold every individual into a new creation, different from their individual origins. Immigrants could remember their place of origin, but looked forward to a new purpose and identity that was passed on to their children. They named me Bill because it was the most American-sounding name they could think of. My brother and I excelled at American baseball, spoke only American English, and grew into the American dream. Diversity is a rejection of all that. It's a clinging to past identity or a focus on affiliation with a minority. Although there may be a fervent desire for inclusion, the best that can be achieved is to be tolerated by your fellow Americans. Tolerated because you are not like them. Tolerated because your true membership is in your minority group and not the national identity. Because it is unnatural, tolerance must be legislated and agonized about. When Martin Luther King championed civil rights for African Americans, his prayer was that one day all Americans would be accepted for the content of their character, their universal value, instead of the color of their skin, their minority affiliation. DEI takes us backwards to tribalism. It emphasizes the characteristics that divide instead of those that unite. This idea of class consciousness is classical Marxism, and it has never led to national unity wherever it's been tried. Those in positions of power can invite traditionally excluded people to the table. That's a quote. Who are these traditionally excluded people? They would be the extreme minorities, notably LGBTQ people, those who would have been identified in the past or in other countries currently as having behavioral disorders. This is too complex an issue to resolve in a podcast, but DEI makes it mandatory that nobody is excluded. What about pedophiles or schizophrenics or sociopaths? Which minorities should be included and which should receive psychiatric treatment? Inclusion must be balanced by definitions, but advocates are unwilling to set reasonable limits on their theories. After all, from a secular point of view, who would make value judgments regarding the suitability of a minority? Who would have the authoritative power to make such a value judgment? Notice also that the implementation of inclusiveness also requires having advocates in power. Remember the slogan, power to the people, from the 1960s? That has morphed into power over the people in this decade. Nevertheless, DEI is on the march through all our institutions and corporations by using language that seems kind and constructive. Inclusion is the new tolerance, because inclusion implies a welcoming spirit, whereas tolerance sounds more like just putting up with something. As I said earlier, DEI offers corporate executives cover from accusations of discrimination. Now here's an update on the president's plan to forgive student debt. Forgive. It sounds so generous. Until you remember it's not the president's money. It's your money that he's forgiving. The Biden administration is proposing a new plan to forgive student debt months after the Supreme Court struck down President Joe Biden's sweeping pandemic-era debt relief plan in June. The new plan targets four categories of borrowers: those with federal student loan balances that exceed the original borrowed amount, those with loans that entered into repayment 25 years ago or more, those with loans for career training programs that led to unreasonable debt loads or provided insufficient earnings, and those who are eligible for forgiveness under other repayment plans but have not applied for it. That's what one reporter said, but what does it mean? Loan balances that exceed the original loan and loans that originated more than 25 years ago sound like borrowers that failed to pay in a timely manner and incurred penalties. Unreasonable debt loads also imply loan amounts the borrower thinks to be too high. The Biden plan bails out the least responsible of the borrowers. The department also said it is considering student debt relief for a fifth group of borrowers who are experiencing financial hardship that the current student loan system does not currently adequately address. We can only guess what that means. President Biden and I are committed to helping borrowers who've been failed by our country's broken and unaffordable student loan systems, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said in a statement, adding that the aid would build upon $127 billion in loan forgiveness the administration has approved for about 3.6 million borrowers. Biden discusses efforts to ease the burden of student debt. We are fighting to ensure that student debt does not stand in the way of opportunity or prevent borrowers from realizing the benefits of their higher education, he said. Whereas the president's original plan canceled student debt across the board, the new plan is directed at the loans least likely to be repaid. However, it's still unclear whether all these borrowers deserve assistance. Some may be able to pay but just don't want to, and think, what do I have to lose by not paying? A better plan would be to require something of those whose loans are accommodated, such as an amount of voluntary community service. The bigger issue is that undoing loans is not a constitutional role of the federal government, nor is the management of education. Violating the Constitution is not merely an abstract concept. It has consequences. Now here's a story from Greece. One of the most legendary soccer players of his time received a jail sentence and a fine for posting transphobic social media messages citing the Bible's creation account. God created Adam and Eve, wrote retired Greek football legend Vasilis Tsiartas in the second of two Facebook posts opposing a 2017 law that would have lowered the age to legally change one's gender to 15 and removed other legal barriers. While citing the book of Genesis, the 18-year soccer standout explained his faith-based objection to extreme gender ideology and the redefinition of marriage. Anyone can have his preferences, whether he is a man or a woman, and I completely respect that. For me, however, a couple is only a man and a woman, the rest are just together. I'm not going to accept all the weddings, all the parades, and anything else they do as normal, Tsiartas wrote. The Transgender Support Association, which brought the lawsuit, called punishing his biblical views particularly important for the transgender community. This story reveals that there is no neutral ground for government. The courts had to make a choice to defend the freedom of speech of Bible believers or transsexuals. They chose preference for the trans community, but it wasn't merely a choice. The courts could have decided that Bible believers have a right to their opinion, and that words have no tangible negative effect on trans rights. Instead, the courts decided to suppress and punish the Bible believer, putting trans rights above intellectual freedom. This is because government leaders see themselves as agents of societal change, who actually favor one societal group over the other. The trans people won the day in identity politics, again illustrating the problem of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Inclusion is inherently exclusionary, as applied by the folks in charge. Counteracting bias of this kind is everyone's responsibility. But don't expect the political left to thank you for it. Marxism is a champion of class conflict, especially when it is directed against traditional values, because eroding those values facilitates the imposition of new values. Elon Musk has become a little bit of a hero to conservatives because of his efforts to make Twitter more free. The mainstream press was highly critical when Musk laid off employees responsible for keeping the platform free of misinformation immediately before the last midterm elections. Laid-off staff complained that layoffs could bring chaos around the elections, as they hit especially hard on teams responsible for the curation of trending topics and for the engineering side of user health, which works on content moderation and site integrity. What the press doesn't point out is that these former Truth Patrol members were highly biased, and Musk decided there was no way to verify the truth other than allow everyone to have freedom and let the cream rise to the top. Geeta Johar, a Columbia University business professor who has studied misinformation on Twitter, expressed the elitist viewpoint, saying the job cuts risk turning the site into a free-for-all with rumors, conspiracy theories, and falsehoods taking hold on the platform and in people's imagination. People like Johar want so-called experts to determine what is true. I recently was involved in a Board of Trustees discussion in which one of the trustees suggested we should consult an attorney rather than share opinions. It never occurred to him to question that an attorney would just be expressing another opinion. Such is the naive bias of modern liberals. Rejecting God's authority, they look for special human authorities to make every ruling. It's a formula for surrendering power to authoritarian leaders. It's un-American because we the people are intended to rule our nation. My final story for this episode is the Dutch farmers. About 3 years ago, farmers took to the streets to protest the plan presented by former Deputy Prime Minister Johan Remkes to meet the nitrogen standards demanded by the European Union. It was a classical example of government overreach. Remkes laid out a plan that would see farms located close to protected environments forcibly relocated, and a scheme for the government to seize up to 600 farms that emit the most nitrogen. The plan to relocate farms has drawn particular ire from the Farmers Defense Force, with a spokesman describing the measure as a red line for farmers. Defending his proposals, Remkes said last week that as a result of the European Union's green agenda, the Netherlands will be locked up because it will be legally almost impossible to issue permits, not for houses, not for farms, not for roads. From its inception, the problem with the European Union is that unelected officials exert absolute power over real nations and their people. The EU demands regulations, and the Dutch government must comply because the EU has regulatory control. Fortunately, the farmers are having no part of it, and the Dutch people asserted themselves in their most recent election. The farmer citizen movement, called the BBB, was only set up in 2019 in the wake of widespread farmers' protests, but won a sizable number of Senate seats with almost 20% of the vote. This isn't normal, but actually it is. It's all normal citizens who voted, said leader Caroline van der Plas. The BBB aims to fight government plans to slash nitrogen emissions by dramatically reducing livestock numbers and buying out thousands of farms. But its appeal has spread rapidly beyond its rural heartland on a populist platform that represents traditional, conservative Dutch social and moral values. Shocked by the scale of their success, Ms. van der Plas told reporters that voters normally stayed at home if they lost faith in politics, but today people have shown they can't stay at home any longer. We won't be ignored anymore. It's a sign that even in socialism-dominated Europe, the people can win over oppression. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, go out and do good.